Accession number 4666, reel 1.
Accession number 4666, reel number 1.
Lord Gridley, reel 1. Before we get on to Malaya, Singapore and internment, tell me a little bit about your home background and experiences, your upbringing.
Well, my father was in Parliament as a Conservative for 35 years, and he was chairman of the 1922 committee when Churchill was Prime Minister. And all of the time when I was overseas during that period, particularly the latter period when he became chairman of the 1922, he was in close touch with Churchill, and one of his duties every week was to keep Churchill in touch with the opinion of the government supporters in the House of Commons. During those years, he wrote to me at regular intervals and kept me in touch with all events that were happening at home, and we were brought up very much to believe in our imperial history, Parliament, and that sort of thing.
Mm. Where was your home? Where were you brought up?
I was brought up, first of all, in the north of England. My early childhood days were spent up there. And during the First World War, my father was brought down by Churchill, who was then Minister of Munitions, to become controller of electricity supply for Great Britain. Mm. So his associations with Churchill started from the First World War, and he maintained very close contact with him during the Second World War.
What kind of childhood would you say you had?
I had an exceedingly happy childhood. I had a brother and three sisters. My mother more or less brought us up because my father was continuously away, generally in London, as I have already explained. We were living in the north of England at Saltburn, and we were accustomed to the northeast gales and winds. And I had a very healthy, Spartan upbringing as a child, let's put it that way.
In what sense Spartan?
Well, it's much colder to live up there in that part of the world than it is in the south, to which where we moved subsequently. I went to a prep school there where it was a pretty tough prep school called Glenhouse School. Even at an early age, we were taken out camping and that kind of thing, even in the winter. I look upon my childhood as no-nonsense sort of period, where we were meant to stand on our own feet as much as possible at an early age, and we were subjected to a fairly rigid discipline.
I get the impression that, in a way, your mother might have been the greater influence of your early life.
This is absolutely true. You've hit the nail on the head. My mother, we were devoted to my mother. My mother in my early age group, say from 4 to 13, was the predominant figure in my life and in the lives of all of us, for we very seldom saw our father at all. And I had a great affection for my mother right up to the time that she eventually died. She was the predominant influence in my life, and I think in the lives of most of us.
Was your father's frequent absence, did it lead in any way to a sort of sense of distance from him?
I think it did. I must say I had a great respect for my father, but a certain amount of fear for him. He was a very rigid disciplinarian. His attitude was that little children should be seen and not heard. This is a sort of attitude he adopted towards us. It was only in latter years, when I became 18 and 19, and actually when I went overseas, that my affection for him grew, because I could see what a great man he really was and how he had got on in the world. He'd risen. We didn't inherit any particular wealth. He was a Bristol Grammar School boy, and as I say, he finished up with a peerage, and I think his achievements were very, very considerable.
What was his business before he got into politics?
He was an electrical engineer, Amongst his other duties in the latter part of his life, he became president of the British Chambers of Commerce. And he spoke on electricity, electrical affairs in the House of Commons. He was the spokesman for the electrical industry. And one very interesting point I would like to make what he did was when the electricity bill came before the House of Commons, and Shinwell then was responsible for introducing the bill to nationalise electricity in Great Britain, my father opposed it. And Shinwell, as you know, is in the House today. Shinwell offered my father, he was so impressed with my father that he offered him at the end of that debate, although they'd been opponents, the chairmanship of Southern Areas Electricity Board, which my father refused, but he never forgot that gesture made by Shinwell, who's alive today.
Apart from being a politician, would you describe your father as an engineer or a businessman?
I think you could say he was more of an engineer than a businessman. He was never a prosperous man in the financial sense. He was a very knowledgeable man with expertise. He never sought wealth. He was absolutely meticulous. He'd never take some of the benefits that one can obtain from being a chairman of a company. I know for a fact he always bought his own car. He never would take a company car. He was a very honourable man, and a man today that people come up to me in the House of Lords who knew him when he was chairman of the 1922 and say what a fine man he was. It's been very moving for me to have that experience of him.
Mm. Now, was your period at Glen Howe, is that spelled G? How do you spell that?
Glenhow.
Mm. Was that a happy period?
This was a happy period for me. I was a very nervous child. I think I've got to say that very definitely. Very shy. I found it difficult in my early years of associating with people. I was possibly rather a loner, rather withdrawn. It was only latterly that it was my father who taught me how to fight in life, how to, if you really wanted to get on, you really got to assert yourself and live up to certain ideals and so on. No, my early life was very withdrawn and was very shy and very nervous. I was a nervous child.
As a pupil, what would you say were your strengths and weaknesses?
I hero worship those people who were good at athletics. I always try to achieve some predominance in sport. I don't think I was very successful, but I was far more keen on being achieving some expertise in athletics and things than in studies and that kind of thing. Mm. I was interested in history. I found that very interesting. I had no idea what I was going to do eventually in that early age, and I really didn't know till I left my public school later on, around 18 or 19.
Which public school did you go to?
I went to Oundle, which was a very famous public school in England at that time. Sanderson was the headmaster, and H.G. Wells wrote a book about him. His theory was that there was some good in every boy. There was no failure in any boy who came to Oundle, and it was the duty of the school to find out what were his potential. And this was something completely new at that particular time. He also started, it was a very famous engineering and science school. He was the first headmaster in England to start what was known as engineering workshops. For instance, a boy on the engineering side in Oundle would go into workshops where we had lathes and instruments for carrying out a work which would be done in an engineering works. This was the most, an outstanding particular bent which he followed and which is not followed anywhere else. It was subsequently followed in other schools. You'll understand why I went to Arundel, because my father at that time thought it'd be I would probably follow in his footsteps and become an engineer,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't, of course.
Sanderson, that's S-A-S-A-N-D.
S-A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, yes.
Well, with the characteristic of drawing the fullest potential from
mm-hmm.
Students at Arundel,
mm-hmm. which
of your potentials developed during that period?
I became more a leader, really. I don't think I was a particular success academically or athletically. I became head of my house, which is not a bad achievement. I became a captain of rugger, of athletics and swimming, my house captain. I was in the second 15, but as I've explained to you, I seem to worship athletics at that time. And if I might say something about the public schools at that time, this is possibly a valid criticism of the cult which was predominant in public schools at that particular time, 1920 to 1925 in Britain, when there was a worship of chaps who were a success in athletics, and they became the leaders, really, in industry and everywhere else.
And
it's formation of character, more than academics. Character was equally as important.
Do any contemporary examples to illustrate that point from Arundel occur to you?
Well, we've had many in subsequent years leaders of industry, and for the moment the names rather escape me. The chairman and general, the chairman of GEC is an old Arundel boy at the present time.
At what stage in the in your public school career did you start thinking about what you would do after public school?
When I was about 20, I'd left, I was at home for about 12 months. My father did want me to go up to Cambridge, to university. One of the qualifications to get into Oxford or Cambridge at that time was to pass in Latin. And I explained to you that Arundel was an engineering school, and as soon as I left my prep school, I dropped all Latin. I went on to the engineering and science side at Arundel, whereas the other boys went on to the classical side. I took the entrance examination for Cambridge and failed. Rather disgracefully, because of Latin, so I never went there. So for 12 months or so, I was at a loose end as to what to do. And I subsequently went up for an interview in London. Do you want me to go on?
Yes, please.
I went up for an interview in London for an appointment overseas. And first of all, I was selected by Guthrie and Company, who are big rubber merchants, to go out to Malaya as a planter on their rubber estates. I went out there as a young man, just about 20 years old. I suffered very heavily, very badly with malaria because I went to a very remote plantation in Malaya, and my health completely broke up. And then locally, the government were looking for an officer in the government service at that particular time. I went for an opinion locally, which is most extraordinary, really, because all the appointments are made from Britain. I was selected for appointment to the civil service in Malaya. My appointment was sent home, recommended to the Secretary of State from Malaya, and that is how I came into the Malayan civil service.
Mm. One thing which interests me is, did the idea of an appointment in Malaya, how did you actually come to that decision?
I had a cousin who had been planting in various parts of the world, who happened to be staying with me in England and with my parents. and he was looking about going out to Malaya at that particular time, and I thought it'd be a good idea to follow him. In England at that particular period, which was 1926 or 27, we were in very difficult economic difficulties. It was before the 1930s, the slump of the 1930s, and it appeared to me there was scope for a career overseas, which offered more prospects than would ever be possible in this country at those particular dates. Mm.
When you transferred to the Malay Civil Service, what department did you get put in, and what sort of work did you do?
Well, I was put into the Customs and Excise Department just to start off with, as a cadet in there. And one of the duties one had to perform, or the obligations upon an appointment, were to study the Malay language and have a teacher in Malay, which included writing Jawi script. After being tutored by a Malay gentleman for about 18 months, I managed to pass all the required examinations in Malay, including Jawi script writing. We also had tuition in the local laws, which we would have to minister in the country, and examinations in that as well. The form was that once you had passed the examinations, you were then gazetted as a past cadet, and then your progress up the service depended upon yourself in the subsequent years.
Apart from the exams you had to take for in order to function in Malaya, did you take any interest in any other aspects of Malay life and culture?
Very much so, because this was what we were encouraged to do, certainly to study the Malay people, their customs and cultures, which was most important, never under any circumstances to interfere with their religion.
How did you go about making a study of that kind?
Well, you always came in contact, your work came in, you came in very close contact with these people. For instance, in your office, you would have Malays and Chinese working under you. You would meet them in their houses, as we did. In the remote areas, one would go into the villages there and meet the Malays in what is known as the kampongs, K-A-M-P-O-N-G-S, which are the villages. It's inevitable, really, over a number of years, that you would begin... We would make friendships with them, understand their problems, and if I may say this to you, their attitude towards us at that particular time was that they always used the words father and mother. The government was father and mother. They'd come with all their problems, even their matrimonial problems, and tell you about them. And there was that trust established, which went on for many years.
Could you fill in for me the... appointments you had and the work you did in the period before the outbreak of war?
Yes. Before the outbreak of war, as I've told you, I passed my examinations. I was made customs officer in Port Swettenham, and my duties there were really to deal with shipping that came in, to see that the collect amount of revenue was collected on the imports which came into the country, and also deal with rubber exports and tin exports which went through that port. I served on various committees, port committees, dealing with the organisation of the port. I was there for 2 years, a couple of years in the early appointments, and I went to all over Malaya after that, in chairmanship of various boards functioning for the civil service, which was really to report on the copra cake industry, for example. I sat on the Penang Port Commission. And at one period I was seconded, if I can enlighten you with the more interesting appointments, under the Sultan of Johor, who was then a bit of a martinet in that country, very much a man who was inclined to quarrel with the British, to advise him with regard to his organisation in connection with customs and business matters. And then the war, I don't know, all right, that was up to the period of the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go off the work side. Could you give me some impressions from your own personal experiences of what the sort of lifestyle was generally for a young Englishman in Malay at that time?
I think the life experience was something which I will never forget. It was a beautiful country to work in. When I first went there, we had nothing like refrigerators or anything like that. We used to have the usual ice box, and if you were working up country, you'd have a huge block of ice which you'd put into an ice chest, and that was the way you kept your food, stored your food, which was necessary to keep cool in a very hot climate. We had the clubs, of course. Wherever you went, there would always be a European club. I remember one particular station where I was stationed, which was a very remote area. We'd hacked out of the jungle a golf course of 9 holes, and one of the rules of the golf course there, and we were surrounded by jungle, was that you could pick out of a tiger's pug mark without penalty, pick your ball out of that. There were very few women there. Quite a few chaps had what they call kept Malays or Siamese.
As mistresses, you
mean? Mistresses. Yes. If you were ever married, this is the thing which worries me at present date. We had some very brilliant officers who would have gone to the top of the service. One or two of them married these girls, and they were charming girls, and their promotion was stopped forthwith. They stopped in the jobs that they were in, and they never rose after that. It was frowned upon to do that kind of thing in the civil service.
And it was frowned upon to marry them?
Oh, yes.
Was it okay to have a mistress?
It was okay to have a mistress. It was okay to have a mistress, as long as you kept it fairly quiet.
Was that pretty widespread?
It was more widespread amongst the planters than it was amongst the civil servants. And there have been a lot of people who have criticised us in these years now for that particular idea or ideology, or whatever you might call it, which we adopted, or rather hypocritical attitude we adopted towards that sort of thing. Because in the Dutch East Indies, which are quite close to us, that's Indonesia, the Dutch encouraged intermarriage. And there's quite a number of offspring of those marriages today which are accepted in Holland. And they have had their problems because a lot of them have settled in Holland, and they've had some intercommunal trouble with them. But it was very funny, it was very striking, the difference between us, only a few miles away from them, from the water, divided by the Straits of Malacca, the sea, and Indonesia, and so on, and the two different policies, colonial policies, which were followed by two different nations.
Mm. What was the pattern of your social life?
The social life was, we were mad on keeping fit. Noel Card's Mad Dogs of the Englishman Go Out in the Midday Sun, absolutely apt in describing the sort of way in which the Europeans lived. There were four states in Malaya, Pura, Negri Sembilan, Selangor, Pahang, and each year there was a rugger competition for the HMS Malaya Cup, presented by the crew of HMS Malaya, the Malayan people gave a battleship to Great Britain for the First World War. They paid for it, called HMS Malaya. And at the end of the First World War, the captain and crew of HMS Malaya presented a very big, beautiful challenge cup, which was to be a cup, a rugger competition between the states, played once every year, the final in Kuala Lumpur, and the winner of the HMS Malaya Cup was presented with that cup. And this was a rugger competition which took place every year and caused tremendous excitement in the country. That was one aspect of the sport, which was very popular. We were sport mad. I won the Malayan half mile one year. We had that competition in Kuala Lumpur. Tennis was all the vogue in the latter years before the Japanese invasion. Picnic parties by the sea. It was an idyllic life, absolutely idyllic life. Beautiful life in a beautiful country.
And were the clubs quite a centre of social life?
Yes, very much so. I mean, every evening people would go down there and have what's known as the evening stinger. The whiskey and soda. There wasn't much drunkenness. I occasionally saw people drinking too much, but it was very well behaved. We British looked upon ourselves as being responsible representatives in a way of our country, and it was anybody who let himself down in public before the people of that country was not despised, but looked down upon.
It sounds as if you were a bit sort of isolated, distant from the local community, the native community.
I think this is true, because if I could digress slightly on this, because after my experience of internment, I'm just going back to say, but we felt we had owed them something, these people who'd kept us alive in Changi. And when we went back, we said, right, we'll go into your clubs. They have their own clubs. You can become members of ours. Let us mix. Let us get together. We've had this suffering. Let us get together. Let us integrate, whatever it is. We've been through all this. You've been, and so on. Let there be friendship established, which is something on a permanent basis between us. We all understand one another. They came to our clubs when we went back for 6 months, the Chinese and the Malays. Eventually, they went back to their own. They preferred to develop themselves in their own way, have their own clubs, have their own customs. Not that they had anything against us. It's just that this is why I feel in this country it's going to be so difficult to have any form of integration. They prefer to be on their own. They prefer to have their own clubs.
When did the threat of war first make any impact in Malaya?
I would say about 12 months to 18 months before the actual Japanese attack. We were mobilized, every able-bodied Britisher was mobilized for a month's training by the military, that's to say the civilian conscription. A great deal of construction of airfields took place throughout the country. Military exercises took place by the existing troops that were out there at the time. And when war broke out in Europe, it was anticipated that there would probably be trouble in Japan. From Japan.
What did you get roped in for when these preparations began?
I was, certain of us were given what was known as reserved occupations because of our civil service experience, and it was considered that they couldn't release us for any form of fighting if fighting was to take place, and that Malaya was to be stocked up with huge quantities of food, which in fact happened. Huge quantities of rice were stored all over the place. And it was necessary to have people to carry out this administration. And so basically, while I carried on as in my position of customs controller up north, I also had the responsibility of organizing depots and that sort of thing for the huge quantities of rice which were imported to Malaya, because it was considered that we would hold any attack. We might be threatened by sea, but we were determined to carry on against a siege of the country.